When the conditions of society are becoming more equal, and each individual man becomes more like all the rest, more weak and more insignificant, a habit grows up of ceasing to notice the citizens to consider only the people, and of overlooking individuals to think only of their kind. At such times, the human mind seeks to embrace a multitude of different objects at once, and it constantly strives to succeed in connecting a variety of consequences with a single cause. The idea of unity so possesses itself of man, and is sought for by him so universally, that if he thinks he has found it, he readily yields himself up to repose in that belief. Nor does he content himself with the discovery that nothing is in the world but a creation and a creator. Still embarrassed by this primary division of things, he seeks to expand and to simplify his conception by including God and the universe in one great whole. If there be a philosophical system which teaches that all things material and immaterial, visible and invisible, which the world contains, are only to be considered as the several parts of an immense being, which alone remains unchanged amidst the continual change and ceaseless transformation of all that constitutes it, we may readily infer that such a system, although it destroys the individuality of man, nay, rather because it destroys that individuality, will have secret charms for men living in democracies. All their habits of thought prepare them to conceive it and predispose them to adopt it. It naturally attracts and fixes their imagination. It fosters the pride whilst it soothes the indolence of their minds. Amongst the different systems by whose aid philosophy endeavors to explain the universe, I believe pantheism to be one of the most fitted to seduce the human mind in democratic ages. Against it, all who abide in their attachment to the true greatness of man should struggle and combine. Chapter 8. The principle of equality suggests to the Americans the idea of the indefinite perfectibility of man. Equality suggests to the human mind several ideas which would not have originated from any other source, and it modifies almost all those previously entertained. I take as an example the idea of human perfectibility, because it is one of the principal notions that the intellect can conceive, and because it constitutes of itself a great philosophical theory, which is every instant to be traced by its consequences in the practice of human affairs. Although man has many points of resemblance with the brute creation, one characteristic is particular to himself. He improves. They are incapable of improvement. Mankind could not fail to discover this difference from its earliest period. The idea of perfectibility is therefore as old as the world. Equality did not give birth to it, although it has imparted to it a novel character. When the citizens of a community are classed according to their rank, their profession, or their birth, and when all men are constrained to follow the career which happens to open before them, everyone thinks that the utmost limits of human power are to be discerned in proximity to himself, and none seeks any longer to resist the inevitable law of his destiny. Not indeed that an aristocratic people absolutely contests man's faculty of self-improvement, but they do not hold it to be indefinite. Amelioration they conceive, but not change. They imagine that the future condition of society may be better, but not essentially different. And whilst they admit that mankind has made vast strides in improvement, and may still have some to make, they assign to it, beforehand, certain impassable limits. Thus, they do not presume that they have arrived at the supreme good or at absolute truth. What people or what man was ever wild enough to imagine it? But they cherish a persuasion that they have pretty nearly reached that degree of greatness and knowledge which our imperfect nature admits of. And, as nothing moves about them, they are willing to fancy that everything is in its fit place. Then it is that the legislator affects to lay down eternal laws, that kings and nations will raise none but imperishable monuments, and that the present generation undertakes to spare generations to come the care of regulating their destinies. In proportion as castes disappear and the classes of society approximate, as manners, customs, and laws vary from the tumultuous intercourse of men, as new facts arise, as new truths are brought to light, as ancient opinions are dissipated and others take their place, the image of an ideal perfection forever on the wing presents itself to the human mind. Continual changes are then every instant occurring under the observation of every man. The position of some is rendered worse, and he learned but too well that no people and no individual, how enlightened soever they may be, can lay claim to infallibility. The condition of others is improved. Whence he infers that man is endowed with an indefinite faculty of improvement. His reverses teach him that none may hope to have discovered absolute good. His success stimulates him to the never-ending pursuit of it. Thus, forever seeking, forever falling to rise again, often disappointed but not discouraged, he tends unceasingly towards that unmeasured greatness so indistinctly visible at the end of the long track which humanity has yet to tread. It can hardly be believed how many facts naturally flow from the philosophical theory of the indefinite perfectibility of man, or how strong an influence it exercises even on men who, living entirely for the purposes of action and not of thought, seem to conform their actions to it, without knowing anything about it. I accost an American sailor, and I inquire why the ships of his country are built so as to last but for a short time. He answers without hesitation that the art of navigation is every day making such rapid progress that the finest vessel would become almost useless if it lasted beyond a certain number of years. In these words, which fell accidentally and on a particular subject from a man of rude attainments, I recognize the general and systematic idea upon which a great people directs all its concerns. Aristocratic nations are naturally too apt to narrow the scope of human perfectibility, democratic nations to expand it beyond compass. Chapter 9. The example of the Americans does not prove that a democratic people can have no aptitude and no taste for science, literature, or art. It must be acknowledged that amongst few of the civilized nations of our time have the higher sciences made less progress than in the United States, and in few have great artists, fine poets, or celebrated writers been more rare. Many Europeans, struck by this fact, have looked upon it as a natural and inevitable result of equality. And they have supposed that if a democratic state of society and democratic institutions were ever to prevail over the whole earth, the human mind would gradually find its beacon lights grow dim, and men would relapse into a period of darkness. To reason thus is, I think, to confound several ideas which it is important to divide and to examine separately. It is to mingle, unintentionally, what is democratic with what is only American. The religion professed by the first emigrants and bequeathed by them to their descendants, simple in its form of worship, austere and almost harsh in its principles, and hostile to external symbols and to ceremonial pomp, is naturally unfavorable to the fine arts and only yields a reluctant sufferance to the pleasures of literature. The Americans are a very old and a very enlightened people, who have fallen upon a new and unbounded country, where they may extend themselves at pleasure, and which they may fertilize without difficulty. This state of things is without a parallel in the history of the world. In America, then, everyone finds facilities unknown elsewhere for making or increasing his fortune. The spirit of gain is always on the stretch, and the human mind, constantly diverted from the pleasures of imagination and the labors of the intellect, is there swayed by no impulse but the pursuit of wealth. Not only are the manufacturing and commercial classes to be found in the United States as they are in other countries, but what never occurred elsewhere, the whole community is simultaneously engaged in productive industry and commerce. I am convinced that, if the Americans had been alone in the world, with the freedom and the knowledge acquired by their forefathers, and the passions which are their own, they would not have been slow to discover that progress cannot long be made in the application of the sciences without cultivating the theory of them, that all the arts are perfected by one another, and, however absorbed they might have been by the pursuit of the principal object of their desires, they would speedily have admitted that it is necessary to turn aside from it occasionally in order to better to attain it in the end. The taste for the pleasures of the mind is moreover so natural to the heart of civilized man that amongst the polite nations which are least disposed to give themselves up to these pursuits, a certain number of citizens are always to be found who take part in them. This intellectual craving, when once felt, would very soon have been satisfied. But at the very time when the Americans were naturally inclined to require nothing of science but its special applications to the useful arts and the means of rendering life comfortable, learned and literary Europe was engaged in exploring the common sources of truth and in improving at the same time all that can minister to the pleasures or satisfy the wants of man. At the head of the enlightened nations of the old world, the inhabitants of the United States more particularly distinguished one, to which they were closely united by a common origin and by kindred habits. Amongst this people they found distinguished men of science, artists of skill, writers of eminence, and they were enabled to enjoy the treasures of the intellect without requiring to labor in amassing them. I cannot consent to separate America from Europe in spite of the ocean which intervenes. I consider the people of the United States as that portion of the English people which is commissioned to explore the wilds of the New World. Whilst the rest of the nation, enjoying more leisure and less harassed by the drudgery of life, may devote its energies to thought and enlarge in all directions the empire of the mind. The position of the Americans is therefore quite exceptional, and it may be believed that no democratic people will ever be placed in a similar one. Their strictly puritanical origin, their exclusively commercial habits, even the country they inhabit, which seems to divert their minds from the pursuit of science, literature, and the arts, the proximity of Europe, which allows them to neglect these pursuits without relapsing into barbarism, a thousand special causes, of which I have only been able to point out the most important, have singularly concurred to fix the mind of the American upon purely practical objects. His passions, his wants, his education, and everything about him seem to unite in drawing the native of the United States earthward. His religion alone bids him turn, from time to time, a transient and distracted glance to heaven. Let us cease, then, to view all democratic nations under the mask of the American people, and let us attempt to survey them at length with their own proper features. It is possible to conceive a people not subdivided into any castes or scale of ranks, in which the law, recognizing no privileges, should divide inherited property into equal shares, but which, at the same time, should be without knowledge and without freedom. Nor is this an empty hypothesis. A despot may find that it is his interest to render his subjects equal and to leave them ignorant, in order more easily to keep them slaves. Not only would a democratic people of this kind show neither aptitude nor taste for science, literature, or art, but it would probably never arrive at the possession of them. The law of descent would of itself provide for the destruction of fortunes at each succeeding generation, and new fortunes would be acquired by none. The poor man, without either knowledge or freedom, would not so much as conceive the idea of raising himself to wealth, and the rich man would allow himself to be degraded to poverty without a notion of self-defense. Between these two members of the community, complete and invincible equality would soon be established. No one would then have time or taste to devote himself to the pursuits or pleasures of the intellect, but all men would remain paralyzed by a state of common ignorance and equal servitude. When I conceive a democratic society of this kind, I fancy myself in one of those low, close, and gloomy abodes where the light which breaks in from without soon faints and fades away. A sudden heaviness overpowers me, and I grope through the surrounding darkness to find the aperture which will restore me to daylight and the air. But all this is not applicable to men already enlightened who retain their freedom, after having abolished from amongst them those peculiar and hereditary rights which perpetuated the tenure of property in the hands of certain individuals or certain bodies. When men living in a democratic state of society are enlightened, they readily discover that they are confined and fixed within no limits which constrain them to take up with their present fortune. They all therefore conceive the idea of increasing it. If they are free, they all attempt it, but all do not succeed in the same manner. The legislature, it is true, no longer grants privileges, but they are bestowed by nature. As natural inequality is very great, fortunes become unequal as soon as every man exerts all his faculties to get rich. The law of descent prevents the establishment of wealthy families, but it does not prevent the existence of wealthy individuals. It constantly brings back the members of the community to a common level, from which they as constantly escape, and the inequality of fortunes augments in proportion as knowledge is diffused and liberty increased. A sect which arose in our time and was celebrated for its talents and its extravagance proposed to concentrate all property into the hands of a central power, whose function it should afterwards be to parcel it out to individuals according to their capacity. This would have been a method of escaping from that complete and eternal equality which seems to threaten democratic society. But it would be a simpler and less dangerous remedy to grant no privilege to any, giving to all equal cultivation and equal independence, and leaving everyone to determine his own position. Natural inequality will very soon make way for itself, and wealth will spontaneously pass into the hands of the most capable. Free and democratic communities, then, will always contain a considerable number of people enjoying opulence or competency. The wealthy will not be so closely linked to each other as the members of the former aristocratic class of society. Their propensities will be different, and they will scarcely ever enjoy leisure as secure or as complete, but they will be far more numerous than those who belonged to that class of society could ever be. These persons will not be strictly confined to the cares of practical life, and they will still be able, though in different degrees, to indulge in the pursuits and pleasures of the intellect. In those pleasures they will indulge. For if it be true that the human mind leans on one side to the narrow, the practical, and the useful, it naturally rises on the other to the infinite, the spiritual, and the beautiful. Physical wants confine it to the earth, but as soon as the tie is loosened, it will unbend itself again. Not only will the number of those who can take an interest in the productions of the mind be enlarged, but the taste for intellectual enjoyment will descend, step by step, even to those who, in aristocratic societies, seem to have neither time nor ability to indulge in them. When hereditary wealth, the privileges of rank and the prerogatives of birth have ceased to be, and when every man derives his strength from himself alone, it becomes evident that the chief cause of disparity between the fortunes of men is the mind. Whatever tends to invigorate, to extend, or to adorn the mind instantly rises to great value. The utility of knowledge becomes singularly conspicuous even to the eyes of the multitude. Those who have no taste for its charms set store upon its results and make some efforts to acquire it. In free and enlightened democratic ages, there is nothing to separate men from each other, or to retain them in their peculiar sphere. They rise or sink with extreme rapidity. All classes live in perpetual intercourse from their great proximity to each other. They communicate and intermingle every day. They imitate and envy one another. This suggests to the people many ideas, notions, and desires which it would never have entertained if the distinctions of rank had been fixed and society at rest. In such nations, the servant never considers himself as an entire stranger to the pleasures and toils of his master, nor the poor man to those of the rich. The rural population assimilates itself to that of the towns, and the provinces to the capital. No one easily allows himself to be reduced to the mere material cares of life, and the humblest artisan casts at times an eager and a furtive glance into the higher regions of the intellect. People do not read with the same notions or the same manner as they do in an aristocratic community, but the circle of readers is unceasingly expanded, till it includes all citizens. As soon as the multitude begins to take an interest in the labors of the mind, it finds out that to excel in some of them is a powerful method of acquiring fame, power, or wealth. The restless ambition which equality begets instantly takes this direction as it does all others. The number of those who cultivate science, letters, and the arts becomes immense. The intellectual world starts into prodigious activity. Everyone endeavors to open for himself a path there and to draw the eyes of the public after him. Something analogous occurs to what happens in the society in the United States, politically considered. What is done is often imperfect, but the attempts are innumerable. And, although the results of individual effort are commonly very small, the total amount is always very large. It is therefore not true to assert that men living in democratic ages are naturally indifferent to science, literature, and the arts. Only it must be acknowledged that they cultivate them after their own fashion and bring to the task their own peculiar qualifications and deficiencies. Chapter 10. Why the Americans are more addicted to practical than to theoretical science. If a democratic state of society and democratic institutions do not stop the career of the human mind, they incontestably guide it in one direction in preference to another. Their effects, thus circumscribed, are still exceedingly great, and I trust I may be pardoned if I pause for a moment to survey them. We had occasion, in speaking of the philosophical method of the American people, to make several remarks which must here be turned to account. Equality begets in man the desire of judging of everything for himself. It gives him in all things a taste for the tangible and the real, a contempt for tradition and for forms. These general tendencies are principally discernible in the peculiar subject of this chapter. Those who cultivate the sciences amongst the democratic people are always afraid of losing their way in visionary speculation. They mistrust systems. They adhere closely to facts and the study of facts with their own senses. As they do not easily defer to the mere name of any fellow man, they are never inclined to rest upon any man's authority. But, on the contrary, they are unremitting in the efforts to point out the weaker points of their neighbors' opinions. Scientific precedents have very little weight with them. They are never long detained by the subtlety of the schools, nor ready to accept big words for sterling coin. They penetrate, as far as they can, into the principal parts of the subject which engages them, and they expound them in the vernacular tongue. Scientific pursuits then follow a freer and a safer course, but a less lofty one. The mind may, as it appears to me, divide science into three parts. The first comprises the most theoretical principles and those more abstract notions whose application is either unknown or very remote. The second is composed of those general truths which still belong to pure theory, but lead, nevertheless, by a straight and short road to practical results. Methods of application and means of execution make up the third. Each of these different portions of science may be separately cultivated, although reason and experience show that none of them can prosper long if it be absolutely cut off from the two others. In America, the purely practical part of science is admirably understood, and careful attention is paid to the theoretical portion which is immediately requisite to application. On this head, the Americans always display a clear, free, original, and inventive power of mind, but hardly anyone in the United States devotes himself to the essentially theoretical and abstract portion of human knowledge. In this respect, the Americans carry to excess a tendency which is, I think, discernible, though in a less degree, amongst all democratic nations. Nothing is more necessary to the culture of the higher sciences, or of the more elevated departments of science, than meditation. And nothing is less suited to meditation than the structure of democratic society. We do not find there, as amongst an aristocratic people, one class which clings to a state of repose because it is well off, and another which does not venture to stir because it despairs of improving its condition. Everyone is actively in motion, some in quest of power, others of gain. In the midst of this universal tumult, this incessant conflict of jarring interests, this continual stride of men after fortune, where is that calm to be found which is necessary for the deeper combinations of the intellect? How can the mind dwell upon any single point when everything whirls around it and man himself is swept and beaten onwards by the heady current which rolls all things in its course? But the permanent agitation which subsists in the bosom of a peaceable and established democracy must be distinguished from the tumultuous and revolutionary movements which almost always attend the birth and growth of democratic society. When a violent revolution occurs amongst a highly civilized people, it cannot fail to give a sudden impulse to their feelings and their opinions. This is more particularly true of democratic revolutions, which stir up all the classes of which a people is composed, and beget at the same time inordinate ambition in the breast of every member of the community. The French made most surprising advances in the exact sciences at the very time at which they were finishing the destruction of the remains of their former feudal society. Yet this sudden fecundity is not to be attributed to democracy, but to the unexampled revolution which attended its growth. What happened at that period was a special incident, and it would be unwise to regard it as the test of a general principle. Great revolutions are not more common amongst democratic nations than amongst others. I am even inclined to believe that they are less so. But there prevails amongst those populations a small distressing motion, a sort of incessant jostling of men, which annoys and disturbs the mind without exciting or elevating it. Men who live in democratic communities not only seldom indulge in meditation, but they naturally entertain very little esteem for it. A democratic state of society and democratic institutions plunge the greater part of men in constant active life, and the habits of mind which are suited to an active life are not always suited to a contemplative one. The man of action is frequently obliged to content himself with the best he can get, because he would never accomplish his purpose if he chose to carry every detail to perfection. He has perpetually occasion to rely on ideas which he has not had leisure to search to the bottom, for he is much more frequently aided by the opportunity of an idea than by its strict accuracy. And in the long run, he risks less in making use of some false principles than in spending his time in establishing all his principles on the basis of truth. The world is not led by long or learned demonstrations. A rapid glance at particular incidents, the daily study of the fleeting passions of the multitude, the accidents of the time, and the art of turning them into account, decide all its affairs. In the ages in which active life is the condition of almost everyone, men are therefore generally led to attach an excessive value to the rapid bursts and superficial conceptions of the intellect, and, on the other hand, to depreciate below their true standards its slower and deeper labors. This opinion of the public influences the judgment of the men who cultivate the sciences. They are persuaded that they may succeed in those pursuits without meditation, or deterred from such pursuits as demand it. There are several methods of studying the sciences. Amongst a multitude of men you will find a selfish, mercantile, and trading taste for the discoveries of the mind, which must not be confounded with that disinterested passion which is kindled in the heart of the few. A desire to utilize knowledge is one thing, the pure desire to know is another. I do not doubt that in a few minds, and far between, an ardent, inexhaustible love of truth springs up, self-supported and living in ceaseless fruition without ever attaining the satisfaction which it seeks. This ardent love is this proud, disinterested love of what is true, which raises men to the abstract sources of truth to draw their mother knowledge thence. If Pascal had had nothing in view but some large gain, or even if he had been stimulated by the love of fame alone, I cannot conceive that he would ever have been able to rally all the powers of his mind as he did for the better discovery of the most hidden things of the Creator. When I see him, as it were, tear his soul from the midst of all the cares of life to devote it wholly to these researches, and, prematurely snapping the links which bind the frame to life, die of old age before 40, I stand amazed and I perceived that no ordinary cause is at work to produce efforts so extraordinary. The future will prove whether these passions, at once so rare and so productive, come into being and into growth as easily in the midst of democratic as in aristocratic communities. For myself, I confess that I am slow to believe it. In aristocratic society, the class which gives the tone to opinion and has the supreme guidance of affairs, being permanently and hereditarily placed above the multitude, naturally conceives a lofty idea of itself and of man. It loves to invent for him noble pleasures, to carve out splendid objects for his ambition. Aristocracies often commit very tyrannical and very inhuman actions, but they rarely entertain groveling thoughts, and they show a kind of haughty contempt of little pleasures, even whilst they indulge in them. The effect is greatly to raise the general pitch of society. In aristocratic ages, vast ideas are commonly entertained of the dignity, the power, and the greatness of man. These opinions exert their influence on those who cultivate the sciences, as well as on the rest of the community. They facilitate the natural impulse of the mind to the highest regions of thought, and they naturally prepare it to conceive a sublime, nay, almost a divine, love of truth. Men of science at such periods are consequently carried away by theory, and it even happens that they frequently conceive an inconsiderate contempt for the practical part of learning. Archimedes, says Plutarch, was of so lofty a spirit that he never condescended to write any treatise on the manner of constructing all these engines of offense and defense. And as he held this science of inventing and putting together engines and all arts, generally speaking, which tended to any useful end in practice, to be vile, low, and mercenary, he spent his talents and his studious hours in writing of those things only whose beauty and subtlety had in them no admixture of necessity. Such is the aristocratic aim of science. In democratic nations, it cannot be the same. The greater part of the men who constitute these nations are extremely eager in the pursuit of actual and physical gratification. As they are always dissatisfied with the position which they occupy, and are always free to leave it, they think of nothing but the means of changing their fortune, or of increasing it. To minds thus predisposed, every new method which leads by a shorter road to wealth, every machine which spares labor, every instrument which diminishes the cost of production, every discovery which facilitates pleasures or augments them, seems to be the grandest effort of the human intellect. It is chiefly from these motives that a democratic people addicts itself to scientific pursuits, that it understands and that it respects them. In aristocratic ages, science is more particularly called upon to furnish gratification to the mind, in democracies, to the body. You may be sure that the more a nation is democratic, enlightened, and free, the greater will be the number of these interested promoters of scientific genius, and the more will discoveries immediately applicable to productive industry confer gain, fame, and even power on their authors. For in democracies, the working class takes a part in public affairs, and public honors, as well as pecuniary remuneration, may be awarded to those who deserve them. In a community thus organized, it may easily be conceived that the human mind may be led insensibly to the neglect of theory, and that it is urged, on the contrary, with unparalleled vehemence to the applications of science, or at least to that portion of theoretical science which is necessary to those who make such applications. In vain will some innate propensity raise the mind towards the loftier spheres of the intellect. Interest draws it down to the middle zone. There it may develop all its energy and restless activity. There it may engender all its wonder. These very Americans, who have not discovered one of the general laws of mechanics, have introduced into navigation an engine which changes the aspect of the world. Assuredly, I do not contend that the democratic nations of our time are destined to witness the extinction of the transcendent luminaries of man's intelligence, nor even that no new lights will ever start into existence. At the age at which the world has now arrived, and amongst so many cultivated nations, perpetually excited by the fever of productive industry, The bonds which connect the different parts of science together cannot fail to strike the observation. And the taste for practical science itself, if it be enlightened, ought to lead men not to neglect theory. In the midst of such numberless attempted applications of so many experiments, repeated every day, it is almost impossible that general laws should not frequently be brought to light, so that great discoveries would be frequent, though great inventors be rare. I believe, moreover, in the high calling of scientific minds. If the democratic principles does not, on the one hand, induce men to cultivate science for its own sake, on the other, it enormously increases the number of those who do cultivate it. Nor is it credible that, from amongst so great a multitude, no speculative genius should from time to time arise, inflamed by the love of truth alone. Such a one, we may be sure, would dive into the deepest mysteries of nature, whether be the spirit of his country or his age. He requires no assistance in his course, enough that he be not checked in it. All that I mean to say is this: permanent inequality of conditions leads men to confine themselves to the arrogant and sterile research of abstract truths, whilst the social condition and the institutions of democracy prepare them to seek the immediate and useful practical results of the sciences. This tendency is natural and inevitable. It is curious to be acquainted with it, and it may be necessary to point it out. If those who were called upon to guide the nations of our time clearly discerned from afar off these new tendencies, which will soon be irresistible, they would understand that, possessing education and freedom, men living in democratic ages cannot fail to improve the industrial part of science, and that henceforth all the efforts of the constituted authorities ought to be directed to support the highest branches of learning and to foster the nobler passion for science itself. In the present age, the human mind must be coerced into theoretical studies. It runs of its own accord to practical applications. And instead of perpetually referring it to the minute examination of secondary effects, it is well to divert it from them sometimes in order to raise it up to the contemplation of primary causes. Because the civilization of ancient Rome perished in consequence of the invasion of the barbarians, we are perhaps too apt to think that civilization cannot perish in any other manner. If the light by which we are guided is ever extinguished, it will dwindle by degrees and expire of itself. By dint of close adherence to mere applications, principles would be lost sight of. And when the principles were wholly forgotten, the methods derived from them would be ill pursued. New methods could no longer be invented, and men would continue to apply without intelligence and without art scientific processes no longer understood. When Europeans first arrived in China 300 years ago, they found that almost all the arts had reached a certain degree of perfection there, and they were surprised that a people which had attained this point should not have gone beyond it. At a later period, they discovered some traces of the higher branches of science which were lost. The nation was absorbed in productive industry. The greater part of its scientific processes had been preserved, but science itself no longer existed there. This served to explain the strangely motionless state in which they found the minds of the people. The Chinese, in following the track of their forefathers, had forgotten the reasons by which the latter had been guided. They still used the formula, without asking for its meaning. They retained the instrument, but they no longer possessed the art of altering or renewing it. The Chinese, then, had lost the power of change. For them, to improve was impossible. They were compelled, at all times and in all points, to imitate their predecessors, lest they should stray into utter darkness by deviating for an instant from the path already laid down for them. The source for human knowledge was all but dry, and though the stream still ran on, it could neither swell its waters nor alter its channel. Notwithstanding this, China had subsisted peaceably for centuries. The invaders who had conquered the country assumed the manners of the inhabitants, and order prevailed there. A sort of physical prosperity was everywhere discernible. Revolutions were rare, and war was, so to speak, unknown. It is then a fallacy to flatter ourselves with the reflection that the barbarians are still far from us. For if there be some nations which allow civilization to be torn from their grasp, there are others who trample it themselves under their feet. Chapter 11. Of the spirit in which the Americans cultivate the arts. It would be to waste the time of my listeners and my own if I strove to demonstrate how the general mediocrity of fortunes, the absence of superfluous wealth, the universal desire of comfort, and the constant efforts by which everyone attempts to procure it, make the taste for the useful predominate over the love of the beautiful in the heart of man. Democratic nations, amongst which all these things exist, will therefore cultivate the arts which serve to render life easy, in preference to those whose object is to adorn it. They will habitually prefer the useful to the beautiful, and they will require that the beautiful should be useful. But I propose to go further, and after having pointed out this first feature, to sketch several others. It commonly happens that in the ages of privilege, the practice of almost all the arts becomes a privilege, and that every profession is a separate walk upon which it is not allowable for every man to enter. Even when productive industry is free, the fixed character which belongs to aristocratic nations gradually segregates all the persons who practice the same art till they form a distinct class, always composed of the same families whose members are all known to each other, and amongst whom a public opinion of their own and a species of corporate pride soon spring up. In a class or guild of this kind, each artisan has not only his fortune to make, but his reputation to preserve. He is not exclusively swayed by his own interest, or even by that of his customer, but by that of the body to which he belongs. And the interest of that body is that each artisan should produce the best possible workmanship. In aristocratic ages, the object of the arts is therefore to manufacture as well as possible, not with the greatest dispatch or at the lowest rate. When, on the contrary, every profession is open to all, when a multitude of persons are constantly embracing and abandoning it, and when its several members are strangers to each other, indifferent, and from their numbers hardly seen amongst themselves, the social tie is destroyed, and each workman, standing alone, endeavors simply to gain the greatest possible quantity of money at the least possible cost. The will of the customer is then his only limit. But at the same time, a corresponding revolution takes place in the customer also. In countries in which riches as well as power are concentrated and retained in the hands of the few, the use of the greater part of this world's goods belongs to a small number of individuals who are always the same. Necessity, public opinion, or moderate desires exclude all others from the enjoyment of them. As this aristocratic class remains fixed at the pinnacle of greatness on which it stands, without diminution or increase, it is always acted upon by the same wants and affected by them in the same manner. The men of whom it is composed naturally derive from their superior and hereditary position a taste for what is extremely well made and lasting. This affects the general way of thinking of the nation in relation to the arts. It often occurs among such people that even the peasant will rather go without the object he covets than procure it in a state of imperfection. In aristocracies, then, the handicraftsmen work for only a limited number of very fastidious customers. The profit they hope to make depends principally on the perfection of their workmanship. Such is no longer the case when, all privileges being abolished, ranks are intermingled, and men are forever rising or sinking upon the ladder of society. Amongst a democratic people, a number of citizens always exist whose patrimony is divided and decreasing. They have contracted, under more prosperous circumstances, certain wants which remain after the means of satisfying such wants are gone, and they are anxiously looking out for some surreptitious method of providing for them. On the other hand, there are always in democracies a large number of men whose fortune is upon the increase, but whose desires grow much faster than their fortunes, and who gloat upon the gifts of wealth in anticipation, long before they have means to command them. Such men are eager to find some shortcut to these gratifications, already almost within their reach. From the combination of these causes, the result is that in democracies there are always a multitude of individuals whose wants are above their means, and who are very willing to take up with imperfect satisfaction rather than abandon the object of their desires. The artisan readily understands these passions, for he himself partakes in them. In an aristocracy, he would seek to sell his workmanship at a high price to the few. Now he conceives that the more expeditious way of getting rich is to sell them at a low price to all. But there are only two ways of lowering the price of commodities. The first is to discover some better, shorter, and more ingenious method of producing them. The second is to manufacture a larger quantity of goods, nearly similar, but of less value. Amongst a democratic population, all the intellectual faculties of the workman are directed to these two objects. He strives to invent methods which may enable him not only to work better, but quicker and cheaper. Or, if he cannot succeed in that, to diminish the intrinsic qualities of the thing he makes without rendering it wholly unfit for the use for which it is intended. When none but the wealthy had watches, they were almost all very good ones. Few are now made which are worth much, but everyone has one in his pocket. Thus, the democratic principle not only tends to direct the human mind to the useful arts, but it induces the artisan to produce with greater rapidity a quantity of imperfect commodities, and the consumer to content himself with these commodities. Not that in democracies the arts are incapable of producing very commendable works, if such be required. This may occasionally be the case, if customers appear who are ready to pay for time and trouble. In this rivalry of every kind of industry, in the midst of this immense competition and these countless experiments, some excellent workmen are formed who reach the utmost limits of their craft. But they have rarely an opportunity of displaying what they can do. They are scrupulously sparing of their powers. They remain in a state of accomplished mediocrity, which condemns itself and, though it be very well able to shoot beyond the mark before it, aims only at what it hits. In aristocracies, on the contrary, workmen always do all they can, and when they stop, it is because they have reached the limit of their attainments. When I arrive in a country where I find some of the finest productions of the arts, I learn from this fact nothing of the social condition or of the political constitution of the country. But if I perceive that the productions of the arts are generally of an inferior quality, very abundant and very cheap, I am convinced that amongst the people where this occurs, privilege is on the decline, and that ranks are beginning to intermingle and will soon be confounded together. The handicraftsmen of democratic ages endeavor not only to bring their useful productions within the reach of the whole community, but they strive to give all their commodities attractive qualities which they do not in reality possess. In the confusion of all ranks, everyone hopes to appear what he is not, and makes great exertions to succeed in this object. This sentiment, indeed, which is but too natural to the heart of man, does not originate in the democratic principle, but that principle applies it to material objects. To mimic virtue is of every age, but the hypocrisy of luxury belongs more particularly to the ages of democracy. To satisfy these new cravings of human vanity, the arts have recourse to every species of imposture, and these devices sometimes go so far as to defeat their own purpose. Imitation diamonds are now made which may be easily mistaken for real ones. As soon as the art of fabricating false diamonds shall have reached so high a degree of perfection that they cannot be distinguished from real ones, it is probable that both one and the other will be abandoned and become mere pebbles again. This leads me to speak of those arts which are called the fine arts by way of distinction. I do not believe that it is a necessary effect of a democratic social condition and of democratic institutions to diminish the number of men who cultivate the fine arts. But these causes exert a very powerful influence on the manner in which these arts are cultivated. Many of those who had already contracted a taste for the fine arts are impoverished. On the other hand, many of those who are not yet rich begin to conceive that taste at least by imitation. And the number of consumers increases, but opulent and fastidious consumers become more scarce. Something analogous to what I have already pointed out in the useful arts then takes place in the fine arts. The productions of artists are more numerous, but the merit of each production is diminished. No longer able to soar to what is great, they cultivate what is pretty and elegant. And appearance is more attended to than reality. In aristocracies, a few great pictures are produced. In democratic countries, a vast number of insignificant ones. In the former, statues are raised of bronze. In the latter, they are modeled in plaster. When I arrived for the first time at New York, by that part of the Atlantic Ocean which is called the Narrows, I was surprised to perceive along the shore, at some distance from the city, a considerable number of little palaces of white marble, several of which were built after the models of ancient architecture. When I went the next day to inspect more closely the building which had particularly attracted my notice, I found that its walls were of whitewashed brick and its columns of painted wood. All the edifices which I admired the night before were of the same kind. The social condition and the institutions of democracy impart, moreover, certain peculiar tendencies to all the imitative arts, which is easy to point out. They frequently withdraw them from the delineation of the soul to fix them exclusively on that of the body, and they substitute the representation of motion and sensation for that of sentiment and thought. In a word, they put the real in the place of the ideal. I doubt whether Raphael studied the minutest intricacies of the mechanism of the human body as thoroughly as the draftsmen of our time. He did not attach the same importance to rigorous accuracy on this point as they do, because he aspired to surpass nature. He sought to make of man something which should be superior to man, and to embellish beauty's self. David and his scholars were, on the contrary, as good anatomists as they were good painters. They wonderfully depicted the models which they had before their eyes, but they rarely imagined anything beyond them. They followed nature with fidelity, whilst Raphael sought for something better than nature. They have left us an exact portraiture of man, but he discloses in his works a glimpse of the divinity. This remark as to the manner of treating a subject is no less applicable to the choice of it. The painters of the Middle Ages generally sought far above themselves and away from their own time for mighty subjects, which left to their imagination an unbounded range. Our painters frequently employ their talents in the exact imitation of the details of private life, which they have always before their eyes. And they are forever copying trivial objects, the originals of which are only too abundant in nature. Chapter 12. Why the Americans raise some monuments so insignificant and others so important. I have just observed that in democratic ages monuments of the arts tend to become more numerous and less important. I now hasten to point out the exception to this rule. In a democratic community, individuals are very powerless, but the state, which represents them all and contains them all in its grasp, is very powerful. Nowhere do citizens appear so insignificant as in a democratic nation. Nowhere does the nation itself appear greater, or does the mind more easily take in a wide general survey of it. In democratic communities, the imagination is compressed when men consider themselves. It expands indefinitely when they think of the state. Hence it is that the same men who live on a small scale in narrow dwellings frequently aspire to gigantic splendor in the erection of their public monuments. The Americans traced out the circuit of an immense city on the site which they intended to make their capital, but which, up to the present time, is hardly more densely populated than Pontoise, though, according to them, it will one day contain 1,000,000 of inhabitants. They have already rooted up trees for 10 miles round, lest they should interfere with the future citizens of this imaginary metropolis. They have erected a magnificent palace for Congress in the center of the city, and have given it the pompous name of the Capitol. The several states of the Union are every day planning and erecting for themselves prodigious undertakings, which would astonish the engineers of the great European nations. Thus, democracy not only leads men to a vast number of inconsiderable productions, it also leads them to raise some monuments on the largest scale. But between these two extremes, there is a blank. A few scattered remains of enormous buildings can therefore teach us nothing of the social condition and the institutions of the people by whom they were raised. I may add, though the remark leads me to step out of my subject, that they do not make us better acquainted with its greatness, its civilization, and its real prosperity. Whensoever a power of any kind shall be able to make a whole people cooperate in a single undertaking, that power, with a little knowledge and a great deal of time, will succeed in obtaining something enormous from the cooperation of efforts so multiplied. But this does not lead to the conclusion that the people was very happy, very enlightened, or even very strong. The Spaniards found the city of Mexico full of magnificent temples and vast palaces, but that did not prevent Cortes from conquering the Mexican Empire with 600 foot soldiers and 16 horses. If the Romans had been better acquainted with the laws of hydraulics, they would not have constructed all the aqueducts which surround the ruins of their cities. They would have made a better use of their power and their wealth. If they had invented the steam engine, perhaps they would not have extended to the extremities of their empire those long artificial roads which are called Roman roads. These things are at once the splendid memorials of their ignorance and of their greatness. A people which should leave no other vestige of its track than a few leaden pipes in the earth and a few iron rods upon its surface might have been more the master of nature than the Romans. Chapter 13. Literary Characteristics of Democratic Ages. When a traveler goes into a bookseller shop in the United States and examines the American books upon the shelves, the number of works appear extremely great, whilst that of known authors appears, on the contrary, to be extremely small. He will first meet with a number of elementary treatises destined to teach the rudiments of human knowledge. Most of these books are written in Europe. The Americans reprint them, adapting them to their own country. Next comes an enormous quantity of religious works, Bibles, sermons, edifying anecdotes, controversial divinity, and reports of charitable societies. Lastly appears the long catalogue of political pamphlets. In America, parties do not write books to combat each other's opinions, but pamphlets which are circulated for a day with incredible rapidity and then expire. In the midst of all these obscure productions of the human brain are to be found the more remarkable works of that small number of authors whose names are, or ought to be, known to Europeans. Although America is perhaps in our days the civilized country in which literature is least attended to, a large number of persons are nevertheless to be found there who take an interest in the productions of the mind and who make them, if not the study of their lives, at least the charm of their leisure hours. But England supplies these readers with a larger portion of the books which they require. Almost all important English books are republished in the United States. The literary genius of Great Britain still darts its rays into the recesses of the forests of the New World. There is hardly a pioneer's hut which does not contain a few odd volumes of Shakespeare. I remember that I read the feudal play of Henry V for the first time in a log house. Not only do Americans constantly draw upon the treasures of English literature, but it may be said with truth that they find the literature of England growing on their soil. The larger part of that small number of men in the United States who are engaged in the composition of literary works are English in substance, and still more so in form. Thus they transport into the midst of democracy the ideas and literary fashions which are current amongst the aristocratic nation they have taken for their model. They paint with colors borrowed from foreign manners, and as they hardly ever represent the country they were born in as it really is, they are seldom popular there. The citizens of the United States are themselves so convinced that it is not for them that books are published, that before they can make up their minds on the merit of one of their authors, They generally wait till his fame has been ratified in England. Just as in pictures, the author of an original is held to be entitled to judge of the merit of a copy. The inhabitants of the United States have then, at present, properly speaking, no literature. The only authors whom I acknowledge as American are the journalists. They indeed are not great writers, but they speak the language of their countrymen and make themselves heard by them. Other authors are aliens. They are to the Americans what the imitators of the Greeks and Romans were to us at the revival of learning, an object of curiosity, not of general sympathy. They amuse the mind, but they do not act upon the manners of the people. I have already said that this state of things is very far from originating in democracy alone, and that the causes of it must be sought for in several peculiar circumstances independent of the democratic principle. If the Americans, retaining the same laws and social condition, had had a different origin and had been transported into another country, I do not question that they would have had a literature. Even as they are now, I am convinced that they will ultimately have one, but its character will be different from that which marks the American literary productions of our time, and that character will be peculiarly its own. Nor is it impossible to trace this character beforehand. I suppose an aristocratic people amongst whom letters are cultivated, the labors of the mind as well as the affairs of state, are conducted by a ruling class in society. The literary as well as the political career is almost entirely confined to this class, or to those nearest to its rank. These premises suffice to give me a key to all the rest. When a small number of the same men are engaged at the same time upon the same objects, they easily concert with one another and agree upon certain leading rules which are to govern them each and all. If the object which attracts the attention of these men is literature, the productions of the mind will soon be subjected by them to precise canons, from which it will no longer be allowable to depart. If these men occupy a hereditary position in the country, they will be naturally inclined not only to adopt a certain number of fixed rules for themselves, but to follow those which their forefathers laid down for their own guidance. Their code will be at once strict and traditional. As they are not necessarily engrossed by the cares of daily life, as they have never been so any more than their fathers were before them, they have learned to take an interest for several generations back in the labors of the mind. They have learned to understand literature as an art, to love it in the end for its own sake, and to feel a scholarlike satisfaction in seeing men conform to its rules. Nor is this all. The men of whom I speak began and will end their lives in easy or in affluent circumstances. Hence, they have naturally conceived a taste for choice gratifications and a love of refined and delicate pleasures. Nay, more, a kind of indolence of mind and heart, which they frequently contract in the midst of this long and peaceful enjoyment of so much welfare, leads them to put aside, even from their pleasures, whatever might be too startling or too acute. They had rather be amused than intensely excited. They wish to be interested, but not to be carried away. Now let us fancy a great number of literary performances executed by the men, or for the men, whom I have just described, and we shall readily conceive a style of literature in which everything will be regular and prearranged. The slightest work will be carefully touched in its least details. Art and labor will be conspicuous in everything. Each kind of writing will have rules of its own,